Hi, and welcome to The Art of Relating, installment number 11. I'm your host, Zach Schwartz, really enjoying myself doing this, and I'm a psychologist out in town. Remember, we're not doing therapy or counseling over the radio, but we are learning effective humanistic interaction skills. That's what The Art of Relating is about. What are the concepts and skills necessary to improve how I relate at work, at home, anywhere at all? It's the art of relating. And remember, what you integrate is what matters. So you have to practice. It's what gets into your behavior. It's not about insight. That's a step. And it's not about internalizing. That's a bigger step. Get it into your brain so you could explain it to someone. But integrating is getting it into your behavior so that you can actually use these skills. That's what I really want. And please remember, you can write in email to zach@kepw.org with questions or comments, which I will try and answer for the next show. And check out the website, DynSkills, DynSkills.com, where you will see books and trainings and workshops, and also a list of podcasts from this program. So if you missed one or you want to hear it in your own time, they are available on the website. So here we go. First, let's ground, because we always ground first. Step one, set your base. Your feet are flat on the floor, or your butt flat on the chair. Get strong, get relaxed, unlock your knees, unlock your hips, connect to the earth so that your emotional energy, hands, face, etc., have some place to go. Remember, any tight muscle holds the energy. Relaxed lets the chi, or energy, flow through. So set your base, and then the top half of your body is number two, relaxed but hold a shape that says, as we said in number three, your Obi-Wan self is there. You feel value, you feel strong, not aggressive, because that draws aggression, and not acquiescent, because that also draws aggression, but just centered, so no one knows what you're going to do. Free will, choice, relaxed, centered is all part of grounding. So bottom half, top half. Take a couple of grounding breaths, fill up both chambers, stomach and chest, and let it all go. We're in Eugene, so some people say breathe in the purple smoke of wisdom from the sixth chakra through the right nostril, breathe out the green breath of compassion from the fourth chakra. That's all well and good, do it any way you like, but for grounding purposes, just fill up both chambers and let it all go. Four is shake out the kinks. Make sure your chronic places of tension are not too tight in your face, the back of your neck, your hands. And last, self-talk. Chill out, calm down. Two relaxers. I'm a good person. I'm doing the best I can in this moment. Two affirmations. What about you is always positive and true. Think of those. I have value. And finally, unhook. It's all small. Let it go. I'm just a speck living on a speck, only on the earth for a minute, not keeping anything. And let yourself be grounded and centered before you begin. Now today, I wanted to talk about what I call the five interpersonal rights, all in one show, because they're important. And remember, these are working assumptions. They're what I want to apply to the dance that we do. Content is what we're talking about. Process is how we talk to each other about it. And ground, which comes first, is how centered am I? If I don't feel grounded, take a step back, get grounded again, get clear, and then recontinue. If something is wrong with the process, that's what I call points of order. which means put the content down for a minute and do the process. And when those are both good, then we can work on the content, which is whatever the agenda item is at that moment. So, without further ado, here are the five rights. The first one is called the right to safety, and it means literally that you have the right not to be abused economically, politically, verbally, physically, sexually, in any way. The person who determines whether you're being abused is you, of course. And if someone reports to you that they're feeling abused in some way, then you want to hear what that abuse is about and act in a way that helps them feel safer. They have a right to safety. Now, every right carries an obligation, and the right to safety carries the obligation of granting that right to others, helping them stay safe. Most people, by value, will say, if I'm doing couples counseling or family counseling or mediating a work situation, that, yes, nobody should get abused, and we should all treat each other in a way that makes us all feel safe. So that's the right to safety. The second right is the right to space. And the right to space says that you have the right to pause an interaction whenever you'd like to what I call go to a neutral corner or step away or give yourself an opportunity to ground. I often tell people who are working, say, on a security staff, what have you, that when they want space, they might say, for example, I've got to go throw up. I'll be right back. Well, when you say you got to go throw up, people tend to let you go. They don't follow you. And that's what you want, is to be alone for a minute, to ground and recollect your thoughts and make a plan, and then to come back and reconnect. And that's, there are two obligations. One obligation of the right to space is you have the obligation to return and resolve so that when you take space, you're not avoiding, you're not shutting anybody up, you're not saying we won't have this conversation anymore. In fact, in a caring relationship of equals, no topic is done or resolved until all parties feel that it is. As long as somebody doesn't feel resolved about what's happening, then we have to continue the interaction and work toward that end. The other obligation of the right to space is that you give space when it's asked for. Now, a lot of couples, some people I work with, when I'm mediating in any dyad, there are what I call pursuers and avoiders. Some people, by style, have trouble giving space. They want to settle this, they want to settle it now, they want to keep talking about it. It's like the hare and the tortoise, and the pursuers I call the hare. They're always jumping toward, saying, let's finish this, let's keep talking. I myself, by style, am a pursuer, and neither of these is better than the other. They're just different styles of being. But we pursuers, tend to partner with what I call avoiders. And again, avoiding is not a bad thing. It's just what we do. So, by style. And avoiders are more like the tortoise. When they get buttons pushed, when things are not resolved, they tend to pull into their shell or tend to... They have no trouble giving space or taking space. That's what they're naturally inclined to do anyway. Their struggle is to return and resolve, because once they calm down, they hesitate to continue the conversation. And in some couples or some pairs of people, of course, people take turns. They're part hare, part tortoise. There's various variations on that theme, but generally, one tends to pursue, one tends to avoid. As a pursuer, I had to learn to give space when it was asked for. If my partner says stop or slow down or time out or neutral corners, any way you signal that that's what you want, my natural tendency was to say, why? We don't need a timeout. Let's keep talking and finish this. But what I would do is, or what I learned to do, is when she says timeout or stop or neutral corners, is to grant that and remember that the other part, the party asking for space, doesn't need a reason to call time. Anytime they call time, anytime they ask for space, I want the other person to immediately grant it. If I'm doing an intervention, say a security intervention at the country fair, and the person I'm intervening with says, I don't want to talk right now, you'll see me step back and shut up. Give them space because they're asking for it. They can have a few minutes. The intervention's not over. We're going to talk some more about whatever it is the topic is. But whenever possible, and it almost always is, I want to give them that space so they can reground and they can calm down. Remember, ground comes first, keeping things calm, de-escalating. I notice when a person is elevating and escalating and getting buttons pushed, I find myself slowing down, calming down, being more receptive, being more caring, because that helps them to calm down and get more grounded, which makes it easier to do the whole interaction. So that's the right to space. The third right is the right to self-care. I want each person to spend some of their energy taking care of themselves. Sometimes that means just taking a break. Sometimes it means getting enough sleep or giving themselves the right food or water, doing self-care, taking care of their own medical needs, taking care of their own stuff if they have it camped or stashed or it's involved at all. They have a right to spend some of their energy on themselves. And I ask when I work with staffs at events and things, people to don't be shy about letting your crew leader or whoever's running that shift know when you need to do a self-care thing. And I want them, that person you're reporting it to help you get that and to respect that right. The obligation of the right to space is simply to respect that right in the other person. So when they need something to take care of themselves, then I'm going to help them, within reason, try and do that and get it accomplished. The fourth right is the right to perception respect. Now, this is a big one, and it really matters in the art of relating. To train yourself to stay in the subjective tense when you're describing your own reality, your own feelings, your own thoughts, your own perceptions, and to hear the other person subjectively. So if someone says, it's hot in here, what you want to hear is, it feels hot to me. It's much easier to make some adjustment in the environment so that everybody can live with their experience of the temperature than to argue about whether it's too hot or not. Don't want to do that. That would be a violation of the right to perception respect. Each person's perception is different and equally valid and equally important and equally deserving of care and an ear and a heart. You may remember from earlier programs that my perceptions are mapped in my head. I have a collection of maps. All my experiences, past, present, and future, that I have collected are my world, my reality. That's as close as I can get. And remember, when I make those maps, naturally I leave some things out, I add some things in, I change some things around. None of us is a perfect map maker. And also remember that my maps are half perception and half projection. So half of how I make maps is light and sound, etc., sensations that hit me from the outside, and my existing feelings and values and history and mood all contribute to what kind of map I make. So, for example, and this was kind of funny for me this year, I teach humanistic intervention, these concepts and skills, in a couple of hour workshop for the various staffs that work our event, and I teach it in other events as well, out at the country fair and in other places. I have for many years. But people come up to me often after and say, oh, thanks, the training was great, changed my life, blah, blah, blah. And I live for these things. I don't live for these things. I am certainly teaching it because I want to get the skills across, but it's all gracious and all positive and all good to share the feedback. And somebody came up to me this year and they said, your training meant so much to me. It changed my life. I come back to hear it every year. And I especially like the shotgun and outhouse story. It meant a lot to me. And I thought, as he said it, there's no shotgun and outhouse story. What was that a reference to? And that happened two or three times, because whoever hears the training again makes a map of the training, and the map includes both sensation and projection. So each person's map of the training is different, including my own. And there isn't any such thing as what actually happened at the end of the training. All we have is, you know, however many people say there were 200 different maps of the training. So anybody describing it would describe it different. So the right to perception respect means that each person has the right to their own maps, to have them heard, to have them cared about, to have them validated, and to have them included in how we proceed to resolve any situation. The obligation of the right to perception respect is to give other people that same respect. So when someone's sharing their reality, their perceptions, their maps, I want to be good at listening, at caring, at empathizing, at validating. And remember what validation is. Everything this person, whoever you're talking to, says or feels or does will always make sense in terms of their reality, in terms of their maps. If I take their behavior or feelings and I place them into my maps, they may not make any sense at all, because my maps are different. So I have to understand who they are in terms of their own maps. If I let them know that I've made that connection between their maps and their feelings or actions, that's called validation. And you can validate. You don't have to agree. You don't have to have the same maps. Of course you won't. But you can still empathize and validate and care about what they're sharing. Try not to argue about who's right, because who's right fights don't make any sense. Try and listen and let them know, gee, is this what your world looks like? And if they say yes, remember, they know you're listening and they can know that you care. If they say no, they get to go again. You can erase and re-record. Don't argue with them about what they feel or what their map should look like. Just hear it, reflect it, validate it, empathize with it. To this point, try and remember the three working assumptions, because they are subsets of the right to perception respect. If you're trying to understand someone else's reality, remember the three working assumptions. One is they're a hero in their own movie or their own world. So they're going to tend to see themselves as a good person trying to do a good thing. And if I want to reflect and let them know that I understand what they're sharing, that's a clue. Oh, you weren't trying to sneak into the fair. You were trying to share love and party with us and share good feelings. They'll say, yes, exactly. So that's respecting that they're a hero in their own movie. And maybe I can show them how to work their way into the fair or how to join us the next time, so that they're not sneaking across the river or trying to do something subterfugal to get themselves in. They don't have to, and we can show them how to do it. But they're a hero in their own movie. They're going to talk about whatever they're talking about in a way that makes them a good person doing good things, because most of us have the perception that that's who we are. So that's a working assumption. The second one is, and this just came up this morning for me, they know themselves better than I do. I was working with a couple, and the one says to the other, here's what you were thinking, and here's what you were feeling, and here's why you did what you did. And I could see the other person getting more and more defensive as the first person went on, and I reminded them of the second working assumption. And I said, look, he knows himself better than you do. So when you say this is how you're feeling, he's going to get defensive. He's the only one that knows how he's feeling. But when, for example, you say, here's what I'm perceiving, I'm picking up that you might be feeling this, wait for confirmation. If he says, no, no, that's not what I'm feeling, allow him to go again. If he agrees, yes, that's what I'm feeling, okay, then you maybe both understand that moment for the feelings that he's sharing. He's the only one that knows what he feels, what he thinks, what his own maps look like. So give him that respect, and you can check out your perceptions without being aggressive, without laying conclusions on him. I know what you're thinking. I know what you're feeling. Those kind of phrases don't work at those moments. The third working assumption is the assumption of sincerity. This person is telling you what they really think, what they really feel at any given moment. If you think they're lying, and remember, sincerity is the same as honesty. It's got nothing to do with accuracy. In fact, in this whole system, I'm not even exactly sure what accuracy means. But they are being sincere, which means they're reading you their maps as best they can at that moment without consciously doctoring them. If they consciously doctored their maps for some manipulative reason, that would be what we call a lie. But understand, the working assumption is that they're not lying to you. They're reading you their maps the way that they are. If you call someone a liar, if you say, oh, you're just saying that, but you don't really mean it, or you didn't really experience it, I guarantee that the interaction will not go well from there, that things will get more aggressive or more defensive for either or both of you. Now, I can share curiosity or my own puzzle. I can say, gee, you told me, for example, that I thought I heard you say that you hated asparagus, but I see you now and you seem to be eating asparagus, and I don't understand. Now, if you share it like that, you're sharing it in accord with the basic assumptions and in accord with the right to perception respect, and that person will be happy to explain how that conflict can be resolved. Oh, this is why I said I hated asparagus. This is why I'm eating them now. They can help you straighten that out. If you see them eating the asparagus and you say, aha, you lied to me yesterday, well, I can pretty much guarantee from there that things won't go very well between you. So we have the right to safety, the right to space, the right to self-care, and the right to perception respect. The last one, the fifth interpersonal universal right, is what I call the right to an issue. And it's where I often start when I'm working with couples. The right to an issue says you have the right as an equal to put something on the agenda and have it dealt with, whatever your agenda item may be. Just because you put it on the agenda, it means that we need to talk about it. We need to negotiate it. We need to understand each other. We need to find some resolution. And remember, no issue is resolved until we both, you both, say that it is, all parties involved. If someone feels unresolved, we've got to keep going and look for the rest of that resolution. Often when I work with couples, one of the first things we talk about is the right to an issue, because often someone feels like, he doesn't or she doesn't care about my issues, or I can't get us to talk about something. So if we establish an open agenda, it means anytime when you write something on the agenda, we'll have to make a time reasonable to both of us to deal with that item. So if my wife comes to me and says, I want to talk about X, and I say, well, I don't, she can say, well, I'm putting it on the agenda, and that means we're going to get to it. When do you want to talk about this? I say never. She says, that's no good. That's a violation of my right to an issue. If it was already settled to me, I wouldn't have put it on the agenda. So I need a time to talk about that. I say, how about after dinner? She says, okay, we'll talk about it after dinner. That works. But if I say we're never talking about that, or that's not important, or we already settled that, all those are ways to disrespect the right to an issue. And I want you to notice that when couples often don't split up over contact, you know, a couple will come in and they'll say we're getting divorced over the green beans. It's not about the green beans. It's almost always about a rights violation going on between them. So if you don't respect my right to safety, my right to space, my right to perception, respect, or self-care, or an issue, those become, if they're not dealt with, potential deal breakers in a relationship. It's not the content. It's the problem of those rights violations. Now, in vertical systems, it's a little bit different. The right to safety, the right to self-care, the right to space, those are all pretty much the same. But the right to perception, respect, or the right to an issue might be governed by our contract, our understanding that makes one of us vertical. So, for example, you own a lemonade stand, and you hire me to work the lemonade stand. You're the boss. You own the lemonade stand. That's a vertical relationship defined by the work we do at the lemonade stand. If you say it's time to replace the lemonade cups, and I say, well, they look okay to me, I say, can we negotiate this or not? And you own the lemonade stand, and you say, don't need you to negotiate, Zach. I need you to get new cups. You bet, boss, on my way. My perceptions at that moment are not the most important part. I work for you. So in a limited contract in this environment of the lemonade stand, your perception is going to count more than mine because you're the boss. Well, as long as we both understand the parameters of that, then that's fine. And that's how we operate. Now, if we own the lemonade stand together as equals, we don't have a boss for each other, we're partners, then all five of these rights matter, and practically all that we're sharing in the art of relating matters, and we have to learn and follow these guidelines and concepts and skills to get along. So that's more complicated and more subtle in a lot of ways, but doable, as evidenced by this whole program and how we run it. So remember, send your questions in to Zach at kepw.org. Questions or comments, check out the website at dynskills.com. Listen to the podcasts. Join me again next week, and we will continue our exploration and practice of the art of relating. Thanks for listening. Have a good week.